Due to today's public holiday, and in place of The Wire, please stay tuned for a special edition of Service Voices from Radio Adelaide. And please tune in this time tomorrow for Independent Current Affairs on The Wire.
Hello and welcome to Service Voices, service to country, service to community. Service Voices is produced in the studios of Radio Adelaide and is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network. I'm Helen Meyer. Today we're bringing a rather special Anzac Day broadcast. Sadly, war veteran Harold Jesser passed away in 1997. Harold served in New Guinea during World War II with the Papuan Infantry Battalion and played a pivotal role in identifying and mapping what was to become the Kokoda Trail. A few months before he died, Harold's son Peter, who also served in the army, recorded conversations with his father. Today we bring you son and father, Peter and Harold Jesser, with an insight into the PIB and the fight against the Japanese that you will never have heard before. And Maureen Moppio talks about her two aunties, who were in the Australian and New Guinea Administration Unit, the ANGAU, during World War II. Their New Guinean carriers, labourers, scouts, guides and police were highly regarded by the Australian and American military. Maureen's aunties were two of the unit's personnel who carried food on their heads along the infamous Kokoda Trail for the soldiers. Maureen Moppio and Peter Jesser present a strong case for greater recognition for the Papuan people who fought alongside Australian troops to expel the Japanese, and we hope to hear more in the coming year about their gains toward that recognition. This broadcast is of great historic significance.
Well, Helen, the story I'd like to tell you is the story of my father, Harold Jesser, and the Papuan Infantry Battalion, which he was a member of. The period I'm talking about covers from January 1942, before the war in Papua really started, until January 1943, when it was just finishing with the end of the Northern Beaches campaign. I'll give a bit of background about some of the individuals mentioned on the tapes. I'd made a few hours of tape with my father before he passed away in 1997. The Papuan Infantry Battalion, or the PIB, came into being on the 1st of June 1940. Its role was to be a reconnaissance unit, a fighting unit, and a guerrilla unit. In the early stages, though, it was severely handicapped as a fighting unit. The PIB did not get their first light machine guns until January 1943. But in reconnaissance and as a guerrilla fighting unit, they really excelled. Their first commanding officer was a man called Major Leonard Logan. He'd been in the Royal Papuan Constabulary. He was a good choice to the extent that he knew retired police who would be a good choice for the PIB, and he recruited them. But it soon became apparent that he was not the right leader for conflict. His second in command was Captain Bill Watson. Watson really was the making of the PIB. He was a great sportsman who captained the Wallabies in three tests in the early 1900s. In World War I, he served in German New Guinea, then as a reinforcement at Gallipoli, and finally on the Western Front. In the final year, he was commissioned in the field and awarded the Distinguished Conduct Medal, then the Military Cross and Bar. He was a highly decorated soldier. After the war, he was a plantation manager, then a successful gold miner in Papua. On the Kokoda Trail, his conduct under fire was outstanding. For these and many other reasons, he was hero worshipped by his men, both Australians and Papuans. My father, Harold Jesser, volunteered early for full-time service, but his call-up was delayed because he was finishing his apprenticeship. He had been in the Army Reserve, and when he got his call-up, he was sent to Port Moresby as a corporal with the engineers. He commenced there in May 1940. Among the jobs he had in Port Moresby was that of managing the construction of gun emplacements on Parga Hill, which overlooked the harbour. The labour for this job was provided by the new recruits for the PIB. Consequently, Harold Jesser was working with the PIB and with Bill Watson from the start. It was because he got on so well with the Papuans and with Watson that Watson arranged for him to be commissioned as a lieutenant and transferred to the PIB. Now, the labouring work for the PIB continued, but the Japanese entered the war in December 1941, and by late January 1942, Rabaul had fallen. It was assumed that sooner or later, the Japanese would try to take Port Moresby. As the mountains behind Port Moresby were considered to be impassable, it was assumed that that attack would come from the sea. There were pitifully few troops in Port Moresby, so the decision was made to prepare to conduct a guerrilla war from the mountains until help arrived. For that, they would need good maps, maps of the plantations around Sagere in the mountains behind Port Moresby. The job of making those maps was given to the PIB, and the patrol was led by Harold Jesser. In late January 1942, they set about their task.
When we got up there, six natives and a fellow from the artillery. We went round, the first place we went to was old Sapson at Koitaki, and he said, "You're wasting your time." He said, "Every plantation around here has got maps of the area." He said, "They've all got maps, and they all adjoined, eh?" So what we did, we went and collected the maps. No, they only took a couple. We were given a week or something, 10 days. Sitting down, I said, "What are we going to do now?" One of the natives said, "What about we go to Kokoda?" Yeah, fair enough. So we just packed up and left for Kokoda, but told nobody. And we took, from Koitaki, we're saying, not from the jeep head, which was about another day's walk away from, eventually, from Koitaki, 6 days over and 5 days back, because we dropped we left Tucker as we went.
Yes.
This day's us. And we came back with nothing, just with what we're going to camp on, a blanket and ground sheet, that was all. So we had to carry, and when we got back, what is hell to play? Where you been? Being over to Kokoda. Kokoda? You walked to Kokoda? Yes. We've been over to Kokoda and back. The track wasn't there, see, and they didn't know. There'd be nobody there for, probably 50, 60, might be more years.
Jesser had been under the impression that there was no track across the mountains because that was the official view in Port Moresby. But what he didn't know, and what seemed to have been forgotten in Port Moresby, was that the police had staffed a mail service from Port Moresby to Kokoda from the early 1900s until the mid-1930s. There was no defined track to follow, but it was probably a former policeman who knew the way and suggested they go to Kokoda. This is very significant because it suggests that Papuans are already thinking about what they might need to know as the war came closer. However, as Jess's recollections show, the news that the mountains could be crossed in a matter of days was received with absolute shock. What happened in Rabaul was on everyone's mind, and the PIBCO, Major Logan, was showing signs of considerable stress. Jesser tells what happened.
Anyhow, I had to go down and report to General Morris. He was all right. He said, "Oh," he said, "you should have let somebody know, you know, and that sort of thing." He didn't reprimand me or anything. And he was quite interested in the track. I wanted me to do a report on all the rest of it. He said, all right, that's it. Return to you. You can go back to your unit now." He'd finished with me. And as I got to the door, he said, "Jesser," he said, "if you had to go back to Kokoda, would you go?" And I said, "Yes, certainly." He said, "Oh, good." He said, "I'll let you know." Then it was about a week later, he rang me up. He didn't ring Logan. He rang me up. And he said, "I want you to get a platoon together." He said, "Take another officer with you." And he said, "I want you to go to Kokoda." He said, "Patrol the north coast." I organised everything. Jack Isaac came with me. And I forget who the sergeants were. Probably had three sergeants. We had one sergeant, a native sergeant. About 30 natives. Organised everything. We're getting on the truck to go up to as far as we could, which was Owen McDonald's place. And Logan rushed in and said, "Where do you think you're going?" "Go to Kokoda." Nobody told him. He was a hopeless case. He said, "We'll soon see about that." The way he only got on the phone of Morris. He came back and he said, "Oh, I thought they should have told me. Goodbye." I never saw him again.
On the 19th of February 1942, the day that Darwin was bombed for the first time, Jesser set out with Lieutenant Jack Isaac and 30 Papuan soldiers to commence patrolling the north coast of Papua. Their task was to watch for any signs of an anticipated approach by the Japanese and to screen any lines of possible advance on Port Moresby. Major Logan was medically evacuated about this time and Bill Watson took over as commanding officer of the PIB. Harold Jesser was later promoted to captain and became the officer commanding A Company PIB. On the north coast, Jesser had a monumental task ahead of him. This is one platoon, two lieutenants, and 30 soldiers who were protecting the whole north coast of Papua. There was increasing surveillance by Japanese aircraft. The Japanese landed unopposed at Leh on the 3rd of March, and on the 13th of that month, Jessa encountered the Japanese himself. Claude and Alan Champion are mentioned in the recollections at this point. They were the district officers at Kokoda and Boona.
So we got to Kokoda. We went down to Boona. Oh, I just had a look around. Up to Yama. Just having a look where we had to go and what we had to do. And that's what I was at Kokoda. Oh, early one morning it was. Claude had the wireless. We didn't have any wirelesses. And he told me they were expecting a landing at Boona. And it was in the afternoon, but late afternoon, they got the message. Because I walked all night. Oh, it was about 76 miles, I think. I was there next morning. Then, oh, a couple of natives, yeah, that's all. And that's when we got to Boona. We hadn't got there long, and the Yap seaplane landed. First of all, Bishop was coming back from Gona in a little motorboat, and they machine gunned him. He put into shore and dived into the swamp the other side, Purple Jacket and all. And then they, they machine gunned the, not the house, but the place where we had the wireless. It was a native place where the wireless was. And, well, I see they turned out and they saw me come in, and Alan, our champion, he was in the house sending a message to Moresby. I raced up and jumped up the house and I grabbed him. I said, come on, get out. The plane's coming straight in. You could see, I knew when they were coming in a machine gun. And we got out, and the big mango trees there, we lay there behind him. And they machine gunned the house, they didn't have to wireless. And then they turned out, and they turned, and they come back, and they landed on the water. And before, I only had a Thompson submachine gun, but they were about 400 yards off. Well, that was no good, because the Thompson was no good over it. You could see the bullets out of a Thompson, about 200 yards was there. Maximum, no good close in. So these signal fellows there, there were about six of them. I said, they had 303s. I said, don't let him stop, don't let him land, If he stopped, machine guns the place, we'd be in trouble. And they wouldn't fire. Oh, they're only kids. So I grabbed a rifle and opened up. And I forget who was with me. One of the natives. It might have been Kamani, Corporal Kamani, or one of them. He was with me a lot in those days. And the two, we opened up on the thing. As soon as we opened up, we'd only got about three or four shots away, and he smartly took off and beat it. We made a mistake, they were going for the field. The petrol tank was above the, on the top. But then he turned, when he took off, but he came in high then, and he dropped two bombs. Or they'd only be, might have only been 20 pounds or something. There was one either side, the mission boat. No, it did no damage. But he did no damage at all, other than give Bishop Strong a drenching. And he come up, and he just walked straight past us, never said thank you or anything else. But he beat it then. He got in his boat and gone and went.
Peter Jessa caught up with Maury Moppio at the CBAA conference on the Gold Coast recently and was delighted to discover that two of her aunties had served as carriers on the Kokoda Trail during World War II.
I'm Maureen Moppio. I'm from Papua New Guinea.
Maureen, I believe your auntie was with the Australian New Guinea Administration Unit with the carrier lines.
Yes, she was. There were two aunties, actually, Navalu Evi and Waiapau. They were carriers, so they carried potatoes and bananas to the backline soldiers to support them in their cooking and all that sort of stuff. So they said they would duck in the bushes when they had Japanese planes going past. So they served along the Kokoda track.
Yes, I believe there are about 50,000 carriers employed on the track, because you needed about five carriers to keep one soldier up the front It was just a tremendously difficult task to keep everyone supplied.
My auntie said they would carry bags, billums of foodstuff on their heads and go. And so it did involve a lot of women from the Mekeo area, the villages. They're like 30,000 on average people there. And, of course, women from the Hanobada villages in around Port Moresby.
I was in the Papua New Guinea Defence Force for 2 years in the early 1970s. And, yeah, very familiar with what a billum is, and women carrying pawpaws and taro and that to market. They carry some big loads too.
That's very true. I'd agree. Like at the conference here, I've got my bag, my billum, carrying all the paperwork and all that. But there are bigger ones than that, as you say.
Maureen, I hope you'll be able to take this material that I've given to Helen today back to New Guinea, and that people up there will show an interest in it as well. I know there are descendants of Papuan infantry battalion soldiers who are very interested in the history, and it doesn't seem to me to get as much exposure up there as it really should.
I totally agree with you. The recognition and lack of, even the people themselves just want a medal to show that they have served in the war, like the late Raphael Oyembari, who's shown on the picture with Andrew Withington leading him out of the Kunai grass during the war along the Kokoda track, was with my family in Sydney when I was there back in 1988. He came down to meet up with the RSL group in Sydney, and he was saying all he wanted was a medal to say that he served in the war and a permanent house for him and his family and his sons. And he didn't want to fly down because he was getting old a bit. So that is definitely an issue back there as well. And like my dad tried to lead a group of carriers and a group of the Fuzzywazi Angels were called, that have the hair afro, because that's how they were looked at and called upon. So they'd try and come down through Daru to Thursday Island on their way to walk all the way down to Canberra is what they were planning to do, to try and just get recognized and show the plight of what the Papuan soldiers and the women did during the World War II.
I agree that there hasn't been enough recognition. When I walked the Kokoda Trail, I did it with Charlie Lynn, who was a Member of Parliament in New South Wales, and Charlie was very in support of that kind of thing too, but getting politicians to listen is just hopeless. Really, we have enough problems in Australia getting recognition for our own First Australians. People at the top just don't seem to want to know, don't seem to understand what people have done and how it should be recognised, even when it doesn't cost that much to do it.
So I'm actually surprised, to add on to that, that Sean Doney, if I could give a reference to him, mentioned that even in schools around here in Australia, you don't see a curriculum about the World War II and how Papua New Guinea was a colony of Australia and how the World War II was fought out along the Kokoda tracks and in the other parts of Papua New Guinea. So, yes, I totally agree with the lack of a political level, I guess, to try and impose a policy or something like that for the students, the kids up here growing in Australia, to understand. And even having said that, even in Papua New Guinea, it's not really well known too, apart from some just books written here and there for people to read or children to read.
I don't know, I guess, that much about individual soldiers, except for Kari, who came from the Gulf District, from Malalau in the Gulf District, and the John and Gabriel Harvey, who came from there as well. They were the men that Dad talked about a lot. And I know that Kari was called the big man. He became the regimental sergeant major of the PIB. And Dad used to tell some funny stories about them. But they were well-educated men. They were beautifully spoken. And they seemed to get overtaken and pushed aside by a rising class of young ones, you know, pushed aside, yet they had, I think, so much to offer. And probably too, they grew old before self-government and independence came along, so they never really got the best out of those people that they could have got from them. They were true heroes. They were great men. Great men.
Yeah, it's sad that their stories are untold. I guess the people back at home don't really realise also too the importance of World War II was fought out and everything, and how their ancestors and their parents and their bubus fought or carried, were carriers during the war, to talk about it much. Like you say, the men who were educated, they would have been educated through the missionaries' influence, because they were anticipating Australia giving self-government and independence to Papua New Guineans. So they're trying to build a bureaucracy where they'll have educated men and women in the system. But now, as you say, the shift is changing with the young ones coming through and have different ideas and different perspectives. And the shift away from not talking about the World War II and the involvement of people, but just on the religious point of view, there's a catechist called Peter Torot. They're talking of beatification of him as a saint at the moment. And Marion Valley here in Gold Coast has a little shrine that they're building, and they've asked the Papua New Guinea community here in Brisbane to try and build a shrine in honour of him. And he was prosecuted by the Japanese soldiers in Rabaul.
Yes, it's difficult to know how to educate people so that they appreciate more of their history. They say if you don't understand your history, you're condemned to repeat it, and we wouldn't want that to happen. I think there's a lot more that could be done, and probably people like ourselves writing about it. I've tried several times to make contact with the descendants of PIB soldiers, but I've never actually succeeded. You and I need to stay in contact more, and maybe we can get something going where there must be stories in families there that get told, could be written up and educate everyone on what Papua New Guineans did.
I definitely agree with that, because at the moment I'm in talks with an old gentleman who's 85 years old now. His name is Mr. Charlie Adams, and he's of Scottish and Papua New Guinean background, and his father fought in the war as well as he was also during the war. He was shifted around all the different areas to avoid the Japanese, and some of his relatives were in there. MV Mumato, that was bombed by the Japanese. I think I'll have to double-check that. So I'm talking to them to try and air their stories. And because he's 85 now, I'm trying to tell his story. So I'm recording him at the moment. And he talks about the war and everything. So, yes, it's an opportunity to try and promote. And definitely I'd look forward to working with you and even connecting you with the Papua New Guinea community to look into this area of untold stories, as I call it, yeah.
Untold stories is a great way to put it. There was a little book written called Green Shadows, which was basically a history, and in that it lists the medal citations of all the people in the Papuan Infantry and the New Guinea Infantry. And just reading those citations and some of the interviews that were done in the early 1970s with people is just hair-raising stuff. If you saw it in a movie, you'd say, oh, that's impossible. But no, these people did it. It's just amazing. Really, really is incredible stories.
I got a call from the Papua New Guinea consulate because some of the RSL members were trying to connect with the descendants of those that fought in the war in Papua New Guinea. So that's an area that we could look into as well.
Yes, I think that'd be really good if we could get a little circle going where people are actually, you probably need a Facebook page these days where people can connect on it, yeah.
I totally would agree with that because my daughter, she's 31 years old now, but she walked a Kokoda track 2 years ago. She was meant to go and see the last Fuzzy Wuzzy Angel. I think he was about 85 years old or something. I think so, yeah, that's the name, yeah.
I met him when I did it. He came out at Kagi when we did the track.
Yeah, she walked the Kokoda track and she did say that, Mum, we need to set up a Facebook page to try and connect with the school kids back along the Kokoda track. She set up a foundation and they raised some money to go and build up a school at one of the villages there. And the reason why she also did it is because when I was a little girl, I walked the Kokoda track going to school at Mageri and Sogeri because my dad was an agriculture officer at that time. Okay. So I used to walk along that track to go to school, so she wanted to go and walk along part of the track. I mean, she was brought up here in Australia as a little girl, so wanted to connect to that. So it's good to start off like that and maybe encourage and empower all the other young ones and descendants of the families to connect them to the stories that are being told around, yes.
Yes, well, let's make it happen, I think. Get the stories together, and I've got so much material that is part of a book and the skeleton of a book, I guess you could say, and if there were personal stories that could be woven into that, I think it could become quite an interesting piece of work.
Maureen Mopio and Peter Jesser, thank you very much for this. It has been fascinating listening to you, and please keep Service Voices in the loop because we'd love to be involved.
Thank you very much, Helen, and thank you, Maureen.
It was a great pleasure, and thank you very much for the opportunity, and I'm honoured to have met you.
Time to go. Thanks for your company, and thank you also to our guests today, Maureen Mopio and Peter Jesser. and Peter's dad, Harold, posthumously. I'm Helen Meyer. I'm assisted by Fiona White and Nikki Page. You've been listening to Surface Voices, produced in the studios of Radio Adelaide and heard around Australia on the Community Broadcasting Network. Fittingly, an excerpt from Fred Smith's song Bougainville Sky ends our show today. Fred served as a peace monitor in Bougainville Province between 1999 and 2001.
Ting ting back, long time before me, no God fight them, no God war. Nighty come, me har him rock, rock, poor old man. He sin down, top, top, me hold him long ting ting. Sin down, all he sing, sing. Time crisis come up, all he cry. Blue and as if from the street, and I turn on the light, and I look at old emails I have forgotten which, but why am I telling you?